You're listening to episode 20, the season finale of season 7 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and this is the GNU World Order, and this is the 20th episode, meaning that by my own schedule, this is the season finale. Yes, there are 20 seasons. No, there are 20 episodes in a GNU World Order season, so this is the last one of the season. What that means usually is not a whole lot. I might take a week off or 2 weeks off or something like that, but in terms of there being a huge long sabbatical, probably not, but we'll see what happens. If anything, what I'll probably do is try to design a better system for myself to post episodes on the interwebs. Right now I do the entry, the data entry, I guess, pretty much by hand. I just go into the server, copy the episode previously, paste it at the top of the document, and change everything by hand, and then go over to the RSS feed, the AUG feed, and change that by hand, and then go over to the Speaks feed and change that by hand. And that's getting not tedious, but I just feel at this point I know enough about parsing simple text that I'm pretty sure I could be doing that more efficiently. So I'm going to work on something that'll help me do that. Probably just a little shell script, honestly. It won't be anything fancy, but it should happen. Okay, so I think it's time to finish this season up. Let's do it. It kind of occurred to me for a moment to try to mix things up a little bit for the season finale, but then I figured, why mess with a proven track record? Talking about random subjects in no particular order seems to have been working okay so far, so why bother changing that for the finale? So true to form, here's listener feedback. First of all, I've got Raven, who we heard from a couple of episodes ago initially about, I think, Fedora versus Sabayon, and he was kind of the guy who got me thinking more about Sabayon. I hadn't really given it a whole lot of attention ever. I think I might have tried it very briefly a long time ago, but more recently I tried it on 8 and then I think on 9, and both of them really, really did impress me. I have to say, they did. And so that was cool, and he's been kind of going back and forth between distros trying to find kind of the one that works best for him and best for his laptop. And that's kind of what I want to zero in on this message. So he's got this Toshiba laptop that he's dealing with. And I've had two Toshibas come my way. One was not very good. I really didn't like it much at all. It had Slackware on it. It worked okay. It was pretty poorly designed in a lot of different ways. And it also had ATI graphic card. And I was never really happy. I never got to a great place, either non-free or free, graphic driver-wise, with that ATI card. So that kind of left a bad taste in my mouth for both ATI and Toshiba, to be honest. And then I recently have been sort of holding on to this Toshiba laptop for someone who just has no use for it right now. It's in my possession. I don't really have a use for it myself, to be honest, although I might. My main laptop screen seems to be flickering a lot lately, but anyway, I've got this laptop, and so I've used it. I've played around with it, and one thing that I have noticed about it is that like some laptops seem to have their touchpad sort of turned on for the click to tap thing. Seems to be turned on by default. So you install a distribution, and one of the first things I noticed, because I hate it so much, is that if you tap the touchpad, it clicks. I think that's the stupidest idea ever, because you put your finger on a touchpad to move the mouse cursor, so that counts as a tap all too often, right? How does the computer know that that's not a click? It thinks you're tapping the touchpad to click, and so you end up clicking on things, and it just drives me crazy. So I noticed that right away, because I cannot stand that behavior, and it seems to be the default for a lot of them, and for his as well, Raven. So I told him to try to mess around with synclient. So synclient is a command that not everyone seems to know about necessarily. It's the front end for syndaemon, syn daemon, and syn client. It's a command line tool, and it just interfaces directly with the Synaptics driver, which I guess many touchpads use. That's the driver that they need in order to work with Linux. Synaptics, or rather SynClient, if you do just a SynClient, like on the command line, just type in SynClient, it'll spit out this huge list of all these attributes that you can assigned to your touchpad. And most of them are fine. Most of them are very sensible defaults. For instance, it defines how many, I guess, units, pixels, I'm not really sure what it's counting in, but it defines where the left edge is, the right edge, the top left corner, the bottom edge, the, I don't know, max tap time, the click time, the fast taps, vert edge scroll, all kinds of different attributes about how your touchpad is going to react. So the left edge, for instance, on mine is set, I'm just using this as an example, at 153. I don't know what that means, but that's what it is. And so if I move my finger over actually, I don't care about the left edge. I care about the right edge. Sorry. So the right edge is at 870. Again, don't know what that means, but if I move my finger over to the right edge and move my finger either up or down, sure enough, my terminal, in this case, scrolls. So it's like a mouse wheel. Well, the fact that it's scrolling, because I'm doing that on the left edge, is being controlled by the attribute vert edge scroll. So if you scroll down to vert edge scroll, here it is, vert edge scroll, equals 1. So in Boolean language, of course, 1 would be true, 0 would be false, or 1 would be on, 0 would be off. So in my case, vert edge scroll is set to 1. So if I wanted to turn that off, if for some reason I didn't like vert edge scroll, if I didn't like having a mouse wheel on the very edge of my touchpad, I could, of course, do a command, syn client, and then just the name of the attribute. So I would put vert edge scroll, and then the equals sign, and then instead of 1, I would put 0, and that would turn it off. I'm not going to do that because I like it. But more to the point, more to Raven's point, there are attributes called, in this case, it would be tap button. Well, there's a couple of different attributes. Tap button 1, tap button 2, tap button 3. And this is where it gets kind of, I guess, weird or something. Tap button 1 is a single normal click, a left click, on the touchpad being a tap. So if you tap your touchpad once, it is read as a single click, which, again, drives me crazy. Now, on my Lenovo, which I'm perfectly happy with, I simply turn that off. Syn client, tap button 1 equals 0. And now I don't get that. There's no tap click. Perfect. Now, on my Toshiba, for instance, I can do that, but I still get weird touchpad behavior. And it turns out that my Toshiba is also reading a tap button 2, which I guess is when you maybe have two things on the touchpad. I'm not really sure, because it doesn't seem to do anything on my Lenovo. And then there's even a tap button 3. So I don't know what any of that has to do with anything. All I know is that on my Toshiba, if I leave the tap button 2 activated, then set to anything but 0, essentially, then if I hit the touchpad just a certain way, and usually it's while I'm typing, so it seems to be with the base of my hand, then it sure enough, it reads it as a tap or something, or maybe a middle click, I'm not really sure, and does weird things. So, you know, there are a lot of attributes here. On one laptop, they might do one thing. On another, they might do nothing. But you need to kind of look at those attributes and see what might be messing you up and play around with them. And to get a list, just do syn client, and that'll list it for you. And then to bear down and kind of change something, then it's syn client attribute name equals whatever value you want to try to set it to. So, and I don't think any of this, at least that I've seen, none of it gets saved. So ostensibly, you should be able to change things, play around with it, screw it up, completely change it, and then reboot, and it should all restore itself to its defaults. That's a good thing if you're screwing around. It's a bad thing if you actually want things to be persistent through a reboot. Turns out, KDE, in its infinite wisdom, has accounted and provided for just that scenario. And if you want something to persist beyond all kinds of reboots and things like that, then what you can do is go into your home folder, so cd /.kde, or KDE4 on some distributions, I think, but it's in your .kde folder, whatever that is, and then there is an autostart directory there. So if you go into autostart, it's a capital A, then there might be nothing there at all, but you can make a shell script. Any old shell script will do. I have a synclient.sh, and synclient.sh in my kde/autostart folder is simply one line, well, two lines. Shebang bin bash syn client tap button 1 equals 0. So whenever I start KDE, it automatically grabs or it automatically executes syn client, and it says, okay, tap button 1, if you're on, go to 0, and then it's off. So that's how to do it from within KDE. There are obviously lots of other startup kinds of files that you could put that sort of thing into. I mean, you could put it into the Flux startup script or whatever. I've never tried to put it in, like, .xinitrc. I don't know if that belongs there or not. I've just always put it in either autostart or the startup file for Fluxbox. But putting it in some kind of auto-run type of thing that gets executed upon certain events, that makes it really transparent, so it's not something that you have to go and set every time you turn your computer on. You know, you don't have to go into, you know, one of the first things you do is do syn client tap button 1 every equals 0 every time you turn on your computer. You just make it run on some, you know, maybe even an rc.local for all I know. I don't know. But wherever you want it, put it there, it'll run automatically, and hopefully it'll turn stuff off. And like I say, for my Toshiba that I use on occasion, I have to run syn client tap button 1, 2, and 3 equaling 0, or else I get weird behavior. So play around with it, see what your computer seems to like best. Tim emailed me about bash tricks. I don't really know what the impetus for this email was, except that maybe just he discovered some cool new bash tricks that he wanted to share. Either way, I really appreciated it, because they're really good things to understand, and I don't know for sure that I understand yet. I mean, not really. I understand, but I don't feel like I have internalized that understanding. But this really is interesting stuff, and it's got something to do with some subtleties in bash that you could probably go your entire life using Linux not really knowing about, and yet it's really good to know about, I think. It's this concept of the subshell. And so a subshell essentially is kind of lifting certain commands out of, it could be a shell script, or it could just be a really long line of commands, but it's kind of lifting it out of that string of commands and grouping it together and saying, okay, bash, hang on, do everything in these parentheses and then continue. And I don't know if that has any kind of processor load or threading sort of effect. I don't really know that much about it, but it's something that I've definitely used, and you may have used it as well. If you've ever used the trick of using the backticks or a dollar sign parenthesis foo close parenthesis, where you're saying, okay, do something to the results of this calculation. That's using a subshell. Here's a quick and dirty, easy example. Let's say you need to convert a file to FLAC. Or, yeah, to FLAC. Why not? So you do, let's say, a socks foo.m4a space dollar sign parentheses. So you're saying the results of this subshell, the dollar sign means like sort of the result of, and then the parentheses opens up a subshell. So we're going to process the commands in this subshell and spit back out the results. So socks foo.m4a space dollar sign parentheses base name foo.m4a space dot m4a close parentheses dot flac. What that does is it says, okay, socks, you're going to process foo, actually what it does in this case is it processes that dollar sign sort of first. I can't prove this, but this is what it seems to do. Process that dollar sign subshell first. So it says, okay, foo, or rather base name foo.m4a.m4a. Well, that resolves to, let's see, we want the base name of this file with the extension of .m4a, and the suffix is .m4.a, so we chop that off, so we do return foo. And then outside of the parentheses is .flac. So in the end, you have socks foo.m4a foo.flac. And what does that tell socks to do? Well, it tells it to take m4a and to make it into a flac file. And that way you get a nice clean name in the end. You don't have a foo.m4a.flac. You just get foo.flac. And Sox knows what to do. He knows to convert this entity to Flack, and everything works out for you. So, if that didn't make any sense, let me just say it again. The dollar sign parentheses is a subshell, or rather, the parentheses is a subshell. The dollar sign says, give me the result of this subshell before processing the rest of the command. So, you get foo, because the base name simply chops off the suffix. So you get foo, and then outside of that subshell was a .flack. So everything gets resolved to foo.flack, and then you get the rest of the command, which was sox foo.m4a space foo.flack. And sox looks at that and knows to convert the m4a to flack. It does the job, spits it back out, saves it as a file, you're done. So subshells are kind of cool for tricks like that. You've probably used it for that, possibly. If not, you are certainly welcome to start using it in that manner, or not. Point being that you can open subshells and have commands get processed within that subshell and then continue along with some other portion of the command. It's kind of a handy trick to know. You can also apparently do it with a brace, a curly bracket, whatever. I don't know the difference between the parentheses and the curly brace. I did not look it up, because I got really, really distracted with those braces and the fact that they can create functions. And I had forgotten about that, sort of. So functions in Bash are really cool. And it's one of those things where you look at Bash, and if you look at it long enough, you realize, wow, it really is a programming language, and I'm really learning a lot from this thing. And it's so true. If you start doing Bash scripts, you can just pick up so many great basic programming foundations or fundamentals that, you know, next thing you know, you're kind of poking around at quote-unquote real programming. Not to say Bash scripting isn't, since, as I've often kind of said and thought, I mean, Slackware does so much with shell scripts, it's ridiculous. You know, they use shell scripts like a lot of distributions use Python. And I really like that because of, you guessed it, the Unix philosophy, where the idea is to have maximum portability. And Python's pretty darn portable. I mean, like, really portable. You could even possibly argue that it might be more portable than shell scripts. I don't know if that's fair or not. But Python being so ubiquitous, it might sort of practically end up that way. You know, I mean, you just might not be able to go over to any computer running really any operating system and not find Python on it. I don't know. I haven't actually tested that theory. But my point is, shell scripts are nice. They're very portable. I support them. And if you do them, then you can really learn a lot of neat programming tricks that do translate pretty directly. And I have to say that I already had known what functions kind of like what they were before, you know, previously. I mean, I knew them from little classes that I'd taken or books that I'd read, but you don't really internalize their importance or significance until you put them into use. So in a Bash script, or a Bash command, really, but let's just say it's a script because those are easier, I think, to kind of get in your head, you can create functions and then reuse them throughout the script. So a really simple example, if you open up a text document or whatever, it would be shebang/bin/bash, and we'll make a function. So you type in function, I don't know, dater, D-A-T-E-R. This is going to be a very simple and stupid function. And then you open up the curly brace, and then you write the word date in the curly brace. I don't know that you, I'm pretty sure that you need a white space after the brace. What I generally do is CSS style, or at least what's CSS style to me, is I open up the curly bracket and then I hit return and tab over one and type in whatever that function's going to do. In this case, we'll just make it run the command date. Again, pretty simple function. And then I hit return again so that I have some white space and close the bracket. So now we've got this weird little function at the top of our shell script, and the function is called dater. And what dater does is it runs the command of date. Now, of course, you could make it do any number of things. You could say run date, and then you could pipe it through some kind of cut command, maybe, and cut just the the first field with a delimiter of, I don't know, a colon or something, whatever. Right now we'll just leave it at date. Makes it really simple. And close the bracket. And you do need a little bit of white space around the bracket, because otherwise it looks like you're just saying take the absolute value of this entity, like of a variable or of a term, whatever. So white space around the brackets. And then we can start calling that function. For instance, we can say, let's just say echo to, in quotes, today is, and then we'll hit return so that we get out of the echo mode. And then we'll put the word dater, D-A-T-E-R, and that will be our script. It's not that fancy, granted, but there you go. And then we chmod plus x that script, and then we run the script with a dot slash script name, and sure enough, it echoes today is, and then there's a line break, and then there is the results of the command date, which of course was really our function called dater, giving us the results of date. So obviously, again, that's a really basic example, and that's stupid. In real life, you would just say to run date, because that's what date does. But in practice, of course, you could give that function a number of steps. And I do that actually here at where I work. I do a lot of install scripts, because the OS that I have to maintain, one of the OSs that I have to maintain at work, will do that. Yeah, I can run some installing programs from the command line, so I can get a lot of automation going just from the shell, which is really nice. But what I would use to do is just copy and paste these big blocks of code throughout the script, not really understanding or realizing that I could just run a function whenever I needed to repeat some action, and that way I would only have to change it once in that shell script. I would have just located at the top or wherever I've got the function defined, change the process, and then it would just kind of, obviously, since the script is just calling that function, that's such a programmery thing to say. I'm really glad I got to say it. It calls the function, and any change that you have made in that function obviously is now persistent, because you're just calling the function. You're not actually copying and pasting code. You don't have to do a sed thing to replace something. You don't have to do a replace string in Emacs. You know, you just say, hey, look, I changed the function. I defined it completely differently, so run with that. So it's really, really cool. So thanks, Tim, for sending me the bash tricks, because I think understanding that subshells exist is important, and then the awareness of the ability to create functions and stuff like that is really important as well, because they're a powerful tool in Bash. Last but not least, Dowby or some name like that emailed me, and he said two things of particular interest, I think. One is he said that he, well, really enjoyed Slacker Media, which I certainly appreciated, but more to the point, he said that he noticed, or he had heard or whatever, that I was kind of getting away, or he said, quote-unquote, fell out of love with Publican. And that makes it sound very emotional and kind of heartbreaking. So I don't want to say that I fell out of love with Publican. I think Publican is a really neat tool. It's a really slick kind of workflow for people who are doing documentation. And I think that if you work within the way that Publican wants you to work, then it's really powerful and really nice, and it makes things very easy. I can't forget the first time that I found Publican, downloaded it, I tried it, and it was just really neat to be able to just say, okay, Publican, create, you know, and you give it the title of your book, and you give it the language, and you hit return, and suddenly the skeletal structure of your book exists. It's just right there for you, all laid out, and all you have to do is open up the authors.xml and put in your name and the title page, and then you can start writing, and you know, you just have this good starting place, and that was really cool. And then to say nothing of when you're finished and you want to publish, and it's just like it's a matter of issuing Publican, well, now I don't even remember it, but you know, you say Publican export or something like that, or build, I think, Publican build EPUB, and it just spits out an EPUB for you. It's magical, you know, it's really nice. However, two things. One is that it's really, really a difficult or a, I should say, it's a big install. You wouldn't think it would be. It's public, and it's going to parse some text, it's going to do some stuff. I've already got the whole DocBook base in my system. You know, I can do DocBook now. I've got XSLT proc, I've got XML2, I've got FOP, I've got everything I could possibly want. What more could it possibly need? Well, it turns out it needs like a million Perl modules, and I do mean a million. So the Perl modules are not really a problem. I mean, they're fairly easy to install, really. And if you go to klaatu.fedoraproject.org, then you will see my publican, I call it my brute force publican install for Slackware. And it does what is needed to be done in order to get publican onto your system. I'm not saying it's graceful, I'm not saying it's pretty, I'm just saying it does it. Don't ask questions. It's, you know, it uses cPAN, which is kind of the built-in Perl package manager. It uses RPM to TGZ, which is the Slackware. Gee, I think it's a shell script now that we're talking about it. It's a Slackware script that will take an RPM, as long as it's not an RPM with a whole bunch of dependencies and stuff like that. It will translate it quite effectively to a TGZ, a Slackware installable package, and it will install that thing onto your system. So you do that. It uses Slack builds, you know, SBO PKG actually specifically, I think, or install PKG. I don't remember which one, but the point being it uses every known package system for Slackware and then some to get all of these Perl modules onto your system. That feels really messy, but it does work. I was at one point I was going to sit down and really try to finesse that and take, you know, and go ahead and make the Slack builds proper for each Perl module that publican requires. Go through the whole process of really building up a publican package for Slackware. And that script was kind of the beginning of that. I was going to keep going back to that script and kind of retouch it and make it more graceful and more proper and really work at it. I eventually started getting away from publican largely because there's one thing missing from publican that I just absolutely needed, which was the ability to output to different paper sizes. And publican has built in, I think, as its default paper size, letter size, and you just cannot get publican to change that page size. You can go into your XSL style sheets. You can tell it that it's not letter size, it's 6x9 inches, or it's whatever you want it to be. Publican still wants to output it to letter size. Very strange. And I don't know enough about Perl, certainly, to know where to go to change that, and I don't feel like publican is giving me direct access to the XSL stuff that I need in order to intercept the letter size setting and say, no, not letter size anymore. I want you to calculate everything for 6x9. So I had to drop publican for that. I did my research on that problem before I decided to drop publican. And there is a patch out there that Jared Smith, a former Fedora project leader, wrote for publican, but it just, as yet, or at least at the time, it hadn't been integrated into publican, so it didn't do me a bit of good. And so it just ended up being better for me to do my own DocBook workflow. I ended up stealing the publican XSL style sheets, so I still get the prettiness of publican, and I get the freedom of DocBook. So that's kind of why I'm not using publican directly anymore. It's not anything personal. And it's not, I don't have a problem with publican. I just, it's not working for me right now. I'd certainly look at it again later. I might, actually. I might not, because honestly, I've started really enjoying all the XSL stuff, so I don't know. I may be getting away from a front end on DocBook. But I would highly recommend it to other people. It really does make things very nice. Just be on the lookout for those paper sizes. You have to watch out for that. The second thing Dobby mentioned in his email was the idea of recipes for effects and synths and things like that. This is something that I believe me and Scott Lavender from the Ubuntu Studio Project kind of discussed when we were doing our interview for episode, like, I don't know, 14 or 15 of this season. If you haven't heard that, go back and listen to it. It's a really interesting interview. And he and I started talking about how studio distributions or art distributions need to be workflow-centric, because part of the problem with free software versus proprietary software is that the free software gives you so much darned freedom and modularity that a new user doesn't know how those modules are supposed to go together. You just hand someone something and say, there, look at all the freedom you've got, and they're like, okay, great, so how does this synth go with this application, because they're not packaged together. I have to go find the soft synth, and then I have to know to what format to use, and then how to tell my digital audio workstation that that synth even exists, and then I have to know how to bring it in as a plugin, and so on. And on one hand, once you know it, you're like, oh, yeah, it's exactly like everything else I've ever used. But before you, until you know it, it's just, you're kind of staring blankly at the screen, because it's just, it doesn't make it that obvious. Now, to be fair, proprietary software doesn't make it obvious either all the time. I mean, you sit a new user in front of some kind of professional digital audio workstation, and it's not going to be a magical, oh, cool, it's so easy because it's proprietary, it's not free, thank goodness, I know how to do everything. They'll still sit there and look at it blankly. I've seen it happen. And don't let anyone tell you that that's not how it happens. I mean, that's just, I don't care who designed the stupid software. If someone's got no experience in that at all, then it's going to be the same result. They're going to be sitting there blankly staring at their screen, not knowing what to do until you show them how to do it. So there's really no difference there. It's just that the proprietary software frequently is what people are taught. They learn it in school, and or it's the thing that all their friends are talking about, and so there's sort of a little bit of an awareness about a lot of that stuff, or maybe they've seen their friends use the thing, and so they know where to start. And free software right now, it's a lot of it's new, a lot of it's totally fresh, other people aren't talking about it quite as much, and so there's an unfamiliarity there that you kind of have to get over. It's a little bit of a hurdle. So what we were talking about is workflow-based distributions that make it a lot easier for new users to find their way around. And one of the ideas that kind of, an offshoot from that idea, would be the idea of having preset effects and preset sounds and stuff like that. I'm not talking about downloadable samples or anything. I'm talking about, although that's an idea as well, but I'm talking more about, like, okay, here's a reverb unit. And when you go to the preset menu, there aren't a whole bunch of, there aren't 100 presets, like, here's a big cathedral sound, here's a small cave sound, here's a, you're in a coffee tin preset, here's the canyon preset, you know, there aren't those things, those presets, and someone needs to sit down, come up with some settings that are really pretty close to those kinds of presets, and distribute them, even if it's just a text file with the numbers, you know, like, I mean, you open up Gverb, the Steve Harris LADSPA plugin in any program, Audacity, QTractor, Ardour, whatever, you open that up, you've got five or six fields that you need to set, right? You got the room size, you got the tail decibel level, you got the tail the immediate response decibel level, you got the wet and the dry, you've got the delay, you know, you've got all of these numbers that you can type in. And if all we do is say, okay, look, for a canyon effect, you know, really, really long echo, here's what you should enter. Done. For a cathedral, really immediate long echo, here's what you do. For a small room, here's a good setting. You know, and just kind of distribute that kind of knowledge, really, in some way, in some kind of fashion that it can be accessed by people who don't have all that much experience with those things. So that's something that I'm working on, not right now, not as we speak, but it's on my multimedia sprint list, and the multimedia sprint is happening. The second multimedia sprint is going to happen very soon. I'm just trying to organize and figure out how I'm going to get everyone to contribute to it. So it's going to be audio-based, it's going to be geared toward musicians and audio producers and things like that. So that's something that's getting worked on. It's just something that needs time to get worked on. So there you go. Thank you for that email. Thanks for the email from everyone who did email me. I, of course, responded to a lot of people just kind of via text. You know, I just emailed them back. So yeah, lots of emails. Thank you very much. And let's go for a coffee break. Yes, it is time for a coffee break, so why don't you go get a cup of coffee, and before the next season, why don't you email me and let me know what your favorite kind of a coffee process is. Like, are you a drip coffee kind of person? Do you do the pour-over, where you've got it in a funnel sitting on the cup and you pour the hot water through? French press, espresso? Let me know. We'll have a coffee segment at some point in the next season. Okay, I hope you made that coffee break count, because we've got a lot more to cover. As you may know, if you've heard this show before, the season finales, I try to just kind of go long on the season finales. So let's go ahead and get started on this, I guess. Try to get through everything. Since I was just talking a little bit about the free software music stuff, I want to continue more or less on that same track, although it's not really. But anyway, so first I should give a little bit of an introduction, and that is that I've been writing some articles for a magazine that, frankly, I've been writing for a lot lately, which is great for me. I really enjoy writing, so the fact that I'm getting to write for a magazine is kind of neat, but that's neither here nor there to you. What is here and there to you is the fact that this has given me the opportunity to try a couple of different distributions lately that I might not have really tried otherwise. I mean, I'm interested in other distributions. I'm always interested, but as to whether I'm going to actually sit down and give them a shot for any one reason or another, a lot of times I just don't. But I sat down and I got to try Magia 2, SUSE, OpenSUSE 12.1, Fedora 17, which, yeah, I've tried that anyway, and Mint 13, which I hadn't looked at in a while. And they're all great. And that's kind of what struck me, is that how great they all were. I was just like, wow, every one of these practically has a different desktop, and they're super polished, they're really nice, and sitting in front of them, it's no longer a thing about whether it's Linux or another operating system, and whether it's usable, and whether it's user-friendly and attractive and all this other nonsense. I'm telling you right now that Linux is where it needs to be for people to use it. And that's the perfect thing to think about in terms of why people would want to use it. So I was speaking about how free software gives you so much freedom but doesn't really give you any guidance, and that sounded maybe a little bit negative, but hopefully I offset that with the clarification that actually proprietary stuff does that as well, just without the freedom. But they do have the ubiquity going for them. What I want to say now is a little bit about why the Free Software Foundation, the FSF, and its principles are important. And the reason I want to talk about this is because I think there's a huge tendency for people to kind of forget that the FSF is really, really important, that the GPL itself is very, very significant. And it goes beyond, of course, the fact that it preserves our freedom and blah, blah, blah. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, computer stuff and freedom, I mean, how important is it? Really? Well, actually, it's kind of important, because if you think about how pervasive computers are, having some control over those computers is actually really important, because if you don't have that control over the computers, then you've really just got computers processing all kinds of data, and there's not a whole lot you can do about it when something goes wrong, so that's kind of significant. People tend to forget that simple idea right there. It's kind of is lost on a lot of people. They still have a very, very trusting nature of computers for some reason. I don't know where that came from. I guess it's the whole, well, it's magic, so why wouldn't we trust it, that kind of thing. It's like, well, I don't understand it, but everyone says it's really powerful, and it certainly does some cool things. Certainly they will never go wrong. And I'm not even talking about, like, computers taking over the world or anything. I'm just talking about, really, computers having information that we've given them, and then us not really being able to get back into how that information is being dealt with. People just don't understand that. I mean, talk to anyone about Google. Well, everyone on Google Plus, I'm looking at you. But, you know, talk to these people who are on Google using the Google Drive, all that stuff. I mean, they really don't care about the fact that their data is now out of their control. It's not a big deal to them. They're okay with that. Funny story that has nothing to do with the rest of what I'm going to talk about that, though, is that at my job, there was a document online that someone had created in their Gmail account, of course, and the document existed, and it was on G Drive or whatever, and it was on Google Drive, whatever the thing's called. It's on Google Drive or whatever, Google Docs specifically. And the person got fired, and the person took the documents off of Google Documents, deleted it, got rid of it. This person was the owner of the document, so I guess it truly, truly went away. Like, it evaporated, it's gone. And tried a couple of different things. We tried looking in, like, a trash and stuff like that. But, I mean, the document was simply gone. It was, all the data in that document had been deleted. Because, of course, the people had let this person own the document when it should have never been, you know, a person's document. It should have been the organization's document, so on. So it's not really Google's fault as such, but it does show you, it betrays the level of, oh, it's so convenient, and surely nothing bad will ever happen, so let's just use Google Docs. It becomes like this compounded issue, whereas if they had really stopped to think about it, and maybe asked someone who might know a little bit something about that sort of theory, they would have known, well, let's not do that. There's no reason for it to be on Google Docs. We can host it internally, have it accessible to everyone who needs access to it, and it'll be this ongoing document shared by lots of different people, and no one will be able to just summarily delete it, and we can back it up, and all kinds of great things that you're supposed to do on, like, a computer system, on a computer network, on a supercomputer. And funnier thing is, I guess, is that even after the document was deleted and all the data was gone, wouldn't you know it, the next thing they're doing is creating another document on Google Docs, owned by, I think, another person within the organization. So it's just, it's a repeating cycle, because it just doesn't seem to get into people's heads. So that has nothing to do with what I'm about to talk about. The real thing that I wanted to talk about is that the FSF is obviously giving us a lot of control over the computers that are in our lives, and that is important because computers are everywhere. I'm not telling you anything new and groundbreaking, but I do want to talk about the fact that the FSF and the GPL, it sets Linux apart from the rest of the computer world. And it's not necessarily what you can do on Linux. It's certainly nothing that Linux has that nothing else has. You know, I mean, there's, I think, pretty much everything that a computer can do, everyone else knocks that off pretty quickly. You know, if there's a killer feature on one OS, give it 3 months, give it 6 months, whatever. The killer feature is going to pop up on another OS, pretty much. And that's just true of a lot of things about computers. I mean, even applications, like features in different applications that you may love, there's a killer feature in one of them. Sure enough, give it a little bit of time, and it starts popping up in all different kinds of applications. It's just how it's how computers work. And I think that's a good thing. You know, that's kind of sort of an unenforceable copyleft thing that's kind of happens. You know, it is conventions start to spring up and people start to use it. Now, I'm not saying that patent trolls and organizations don't try to sue each other sometimes, but largely certain conventions just kind of start to get integrated into how we compute. Okay, so that's not a big deal. The big deal, obviously, is the GPL, the ability to share code and look at it and change it and learn it and all this other stuff. And it is the thing that has let a lot of us, a lot of, you know, people listening to this show and myself, learn more about computers that probably we would have just never really learned, you know, before. I mean, I would have never learned shell scripting on a closed system. It just would not have happened for a lot of different reasons, because there's just not all that much that you can apply shell scripting to. So there are other things that you could learn. There are scripting languages specific to a different OS that I could have learned. But again, the portability, I think it really only goes so far. And at the end of the day, you can only do as much as they're allowing you to do. And so the motivation really seems to be a lot less. And I think that sort of high ceiling, or the lack of a ceiling, tends, I think, to, at least for me and probably for a lot of people like me, to have a motivational effect that being in a closed room just doesn't quite have. You know, if someone says, hey, you can learn all of this stuff as long as it doesn't go any farther than 3 meters out. Well, that's cool, but, you know, you start to get close to the edge, and then you're just kind of like, well, what now, and why am I even trying? Because there's the end, there's the finish right there, and there's no prize there. It's just, I've learned everything I can learn. The end. Not that big of a deal. Whereas when there's absolutely no limit to what you can do, that's pretty exciting. And you get all of these ideas. You think, oh, I could do this, I could do that, I could program this. Okay, maybe you can't. Maybe you're never going to get around to actually doing that. But man, can you get close, and you can entertain the idea, and you can hack around and learn new stuff. And there are rewards. There are rewards every step of the way. So that's all important and great. The fact that the Linux kernel exists, and that there are actually alternatives to computing, to things like the proprietary options, that's a huge deal. And it's something that is unique to Linux that I think is actually something that needs to be respected, because that's the true difference between Linux and the other systems, right? Like I say, other systems are going to start borrowing ideas from Linux and vice versa. They all kind of have this weird, they end up kind of being pretty level. You can do on any system conceivably what you could do on any other system. And if you don't believe me, just go talk to a fanboy. Go find a fanboy of any given OS and say, hey, look at what my OS can do. They will be able to find a way to do that same thing on their OS, even if it takes them 3 weeks or 2 years. They will figure out a way to get that done on their operating system such that your operating system is no longer, you know, better than theirs. That's just how it works. Trust me, honestly. There's that. But the freedom aspect is the important thing, I think, when you're going around saying, oh, everyone should use Linux. There's only two reasons for that, really. One is for your own convenience, right? Because when someone calls you over for computer help, which they inevitably will, are you going to have to sit in front of some proprietary OS that you can't stand to use, or are you going to get to sit down in front of Linux, which is fun for you? That's really the only difference there. And the other thing is, well, Linux is free. There's the GPL. So those are the two things that are important. And if you don't have the GPL, then, I don't know, the only thing left is that you just want the convenience of being able to use a Unix operating system or Unix-like operating system when you get called over for tech support. And the reason I'm kind of harping on that subject is because I've noticed something about people. And that is, I know this is going to become as a big revelation to people, but if someone doesn't want to change, then they won't change. And you might be thinking, why are you saying that? That's so obvious. Well, the idea is that the ability to use Linux is not the thing that will get people to switch. And unfortunately, I think that's something that a lot of us don't quite get yet. We think, oh, if people could just sit down and find a familiar operating paradigm, and really, if everything was just in the place where they expected it to be, and so on, then they would switch to Linux. Well, no, they wouldn't. Believe me. We could have 3D games, and Steam, and Duke Nukem, and Office, and Outlook, and Photoshop, and all kinds of other things on Linux, and people still wouldn't switch to Linux. Why wouldn't people switch to Linux? Because they just don't care. They don't care that it's Linux. They don't care if it's any other operating system. All they want to do is the stuff that they want to do. And what they're doing is what they've been, you know, is what they're in the habit of doing. And that's they're not going to change from that because it's just not important to them. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just the way people are. A lot of people are. I know not everyone, not you, not me, but some people are like that. They don't care because it's a computer, for crying out loud. Big deal. And also they've been doing this one thing for their entire life, and it seems to have been working pretty well, so why bother to change? Maybe if you got all those things and pre-installed it on computers and sold it to them, then they would switch. But otherwise, people aren't going to raise one finger to switch the operating system, because they just don't care. They need applications, and if they have those applications on any platform, then they might as well just stick with the one they've always used, because what's the difference? We may have applications that are perfectly suitable for people, that you can sit there and show them everything that they need to do on their application, and it'll do everything that they ever need to do. They might even learn it. They could learn the system. They could sit in front of Linux and be just as comfortable in front of it as something else. But I'm telling you, they still won't switch. It doesn't matter. They have to value the freedom aspect, or they will not switch. Because the freedom aspect is the thing above and beyond the usability, above and beyond the familiarity, and above and beyond, probably most importantly, the habit. That they've got the habit of using this other operating system, and there has to be a good reason to stop using that operating system. And it has to be a pretty major one. If they're not into the computer side of things, like probably you and I are, like the shell scripting and all that other technical stuff, learning how to set up certain conf files and how to get things networked. If it's not for that, then there's no excuse for them to change, because it's just too easy not to change. Excuses as to why someone cannot switch, given that all OSs are basically equal, are basically excuses. And I've seen this a lot. And it's people saying things like, well, I would love to switch. All I need is this one extra thing. And, you know, I mean, it's almost like I wish I could condense someone's life by those those things. You know, there are certain people you know, and all they are their excuse generator machines. You know, it's like, well, I would do that, but, you know, all I need is this one other thing. And then they get that one other thing, and then, well, it turns out there's also this other thing that they need, and then there's this other thing. And it'll just be a continuous string of that, or they'll just never get that one thing that they needed in the first place. Not because it won't be exactly the same. Those are just silly excuses not to switch. And again, people aren't going to switch because if the freedom isn't the most important thing, then there'll never be a good reason to switch. Because freedom is the only truly deciding factor. That's the only actual difference between the different operating systems. And that's the one thing that the proprietary operating systems, by the definition of the term, cannot have. They are not ever going to have the same degree of freedom as a free operating system. That's why it's called a free operating system versus a proprietary operating system. I'm not saying a proprietary operating system couldn't become free. They couldn't just open up all their code if they wanted to, I guess. But it's, you know, I think we know it's not going to happen. So for people that really want to change their operating system, to change their habit, to do something differently, they have to value something above and beyond the habit that they have of using this other operating system. And you'll see people loving free software. They'll use Audacity. They'll use the heck out of VLC. They'll use FileZilla. They'll use Firefox. They'll use Thunderbird. They might use almost a completely free stack on top of their operating system. And they're still not going to change their operating system. Because again, they've got to value freedom from the code base on up, or it's just too hard to break the habit. So I'm not sure what that says about people. I'm not sure what it says about sort of our mission in life as Linux enthusiasts. I'm not really sure what it means. All I know is that when you're pitching Linux to people and when you're talking about Linux, you really aren't, you almost can't just talk about Linux as a computer. It really almost has to be a cause. You know, it's got to be something that is important, that's bigger than computers. As crazy as that might be, because then you almost have to turn into sort of a fanatic. And I don't think of myself as a fanatic. I'm not sure how I come across to other people, but I don't think of myself as a fanatic. And so it does become interesting to kind of present these ideas in larger-than-life ideas. But, I mean, you have to understand, proprietary operating systems do that, right? You know that they do that. They put out million-dollar commercials, or multi-million-dollar commercials, with phrases like, I'm a PC, or I made Windows 7. You know, weird sort of like personal larger-than-life statements being made to guide people down these paths of it's not a computer, it's a lifestyle. It's the way you live your life. Maybe you're rebelling against the establishment by using this computer that you purchased for $3,000. That's so funny. But people buy into that. You know, that's stuff that people really buy. And we don't have the multi-million dollar marketing campaign, but we have us, we have ourselves, we have our own enthusiasm. And we have the value of freedom. And you know, for me, for my friends, for the people I talk to, it's the anti-capitalist and the independent programmer or independent artist, that is my selling point. You know, I don't know how well it's working, but that's what excites me about that, and so that's how I present it. And for you, it might be something different, but the freedom has to be there. It's got to be about the larger than just a computer. It's about a lifestyle. It's about a movement. It's about these bigger ideas than just, hey, look at this Office application. You can underline and make words different colors and use fancy fonts. Can't be about that. It's got to be about something bigger, because it is. At the end of the day, it's about the freedom of data, freedom of processing that data, of getting the data back, and so on. So that's kind of why the FSF and the GPL are really things to respect and to preserve and to advertise, to promote. So think about that, won't you? Thank you. Let's move on. There's a find command on most Unix-like systems. Find on Linux is a GNU utility. I think it comes with a package called findutil or something like that. On some other systems, like on BSD and stuff, it'll be the BSD version of find. But from what I understand, they're pretty similar. They're pretty darn compatible with each other, so learning one typically gets you good with the other. I'll assume we're all using Linux anyway here and just kind of talk specifically about it. But one of the latest conventions or fads in computing, it seems, are really, really quote-unquote helpful desktops that help you find your files, because the assumption lately is that people just can't organize their own stuff. And rather than promoting organization, it seems like the new thing to do is just to tell everyone it's okay, you don't have to organize, you just throw everything you want on a hard drive and use some kind of magical search command to search through your mess and find whatever you're looking for. And, you know, I mean, hey, if you're one of those people who uses that and is okay with that, then great. Good for you. I support you. Me, myself, I really don't like that. And the more I've encountered people who, you know, don't know where their files are and kind of panic, and they're like, oh my gosh, where is my file? This is the most important thing I've ever done in my life, and now I can't find it. It was just on my desktop the other day, because everything, of course, ends up on people's desktop. So I've been called in very frequently lately to find people's files. It's just literally finding their files. And I love when they go up to their operating system's search tool and they do their little search and it just won't find the thing. And it's really strange because there seems to be, and I don't know if it's just a buggy system or like a fluke on that one system, but there are actually a couple of times I can think of where people will go to their magical search tool and they'll search for a file and it simply won't find the file. So for all practical purposes, that file's not on that computer. Maybe it just hasn't had time to index or something. I'm not really sure. But it's happened a couple of times to a couple of different people. So I'm not sure what's going on there. Point is, I was motivated a little while ago to just really start looking at the find command, both for myself, but also to kind of prove to people that their OS is not very good. So I started using Find, and I have to say I've really gotten fond of it. And it isn't even something that necessarily you have to fall back on as an organizational tool, because if you've got your files organized, you can have all your music albums or completely organized on a hard drive, but you might not remember what song an album appears on, or how many albums a song appears on. If it's one of those, you know, maybe it's on two different live CDs and also one of their studio albums. How can you find it? So it's a great tool regardless of your organizational status. It's an easy one to use, and it's one of those with a lot of different options, like a lot more than I ever realized it had. So if you open up the man page and kind of scroll down to about, I don't know, 20 or 30%, you'll see a bunch of different test things that you can pass to it as well to be sure that you're finding the one that you want. So this is really handy, and again, it's kind of one of those things that a lot of other search systems on the operating system might not have built in, at least by any easy method or any method that your user knows how to use. So even if you just learn to use it on Find, you'll still look like a magician. So Find, the most easy way to use it, or the most basic syntax rather, is simply to say find and then the path. So let's just say find and then, I don't know, let's just do the USR slash, or slash USR slash. So that would find everything. It would be looking in the directory slash USR and every following directory, and then we'll just do an iname for Emacs. Let's do that. And you hit return, and it will find any occurrence of exactly the string, case insensitively, of the word Emacs. So I said find space slash USR slash space dash iname, that's insensitive, or, you know, case insensitive name, dash iname, space Emacs. So that means that it's only going to find Emacs as it appears by itself. So there's really only about five occurrences of that. There's some stuff in doc, there's of course Emacs itself in bin, I think a shared folder with all the probably the documentation, the other documentation stuff in it, probably the site user. Yeah, the site Lisp. And there's /libexec/emacs. So a couple of different places, not that many. Now if we change that up, and I'll hit the up arrow, and do a -iname for *emacs*. Now that's going to find a couple of more, because now it's not just looking for the singular string of Emacs, it's looking for anything with something before and after it in its name. So it's a little bit more liberal. Let's also look for just the name, so no case insensitivity, and then look for Emacs with a capital E, and then there's only one occurrence of that. It's in user share themes Emacs. So that's kind of an easy example, iName, case insensitive, or name, case sensitive. Let's do something a little bit different here and add other arguments to kind of further filter down our list. I know that I had just opened up and edited a text document, for instance, yesterday, a Slack build that I was working on, or that I was updating, rather. So I know that I've got somewhere in my Slack builds folder, in my Slack building folder, I know that I've got a document for MScore, that's MuseScore, a notation program for cute-based musical notation scoring program. So I know that there's something that I updated yesterday specifically, and I want to find that exact document. I don't want the MScore Slack build that I worked on 2 weeks ago. I want it I want something within about a 24-hour period that I have accessed. So I could do a find tilde from my home folder, because that's where my Slack builds are kept, the ones that I'm maintaining. And then I can do an iName again, because I don't really remember how I capitalized everything. Let's just do mscore.slackbuild. Actually, I could have done a name for that. In fact, I will, because I do remember how that's capitalized. So I'm going to do a -name, mscore.slackbuild. And then at the end, I'll put an a time, access time. And I can put any value here, from 0 from whatever. And that will be multiplied by 24 for hours. So if I put 0, then that's going to be within the previous 24 hours, like today, within the past 24 hours. If I put a 1 there, it'll be, I guess, essentially 48 hours. And so on, 2, 3, whatever. So I'm going to just put in 1, rather 1, because I was working on it yesterday for sure. And I'm going to do a find on that, and we'll see what happens. Yeah, and sure enough, I get one result. I get the one mscore.slackbuild in my Slack building folder, in the mscore folder, which is where I actually knew it would be, but pretend like I didn't, and there it is, mscore.slackbuild. Now, if I take away that a time 0 and just do a search for mscore Slack build, sure enough, I have 3 results. I've got the one that I downloaded to start working on it, because I'm taking this over from a previous maintainer. I've got the a test one that I had been working on some time ago, and then I've got the real version that I was working on. But the only one that had been accessed within the last 24 hours was the one that I'm actually currently building, you know, working on myself, rewriting. So there you go. A time for filtering down the access time. And there are lots and lots of different little filters that you can apply to find that I think in the really, really basic tutorials, they don't really cover that much. Unfortunately, this also is a fairly basic tutorial, so I'm not going to go through all of them, but know that they exist and do a man for find on find. And look at, well, do a search for a time. That'll take you right to that section in the man page. All kinds of stuff. C min, the file's status last changed X or in minutes ago. C newer, C time empty, the file is empty or it's a directory. The file is executable, -executable. All kinds of stuff. So really, take a look at all the different filters that you have, because I think to a degree they're somewhat forgotten by basic find usage, and it's rarely one of those things, except that a time, that one I use a lot, but the other ones I don't really use them that much. But knowing that they exist, if a time comes up that where I need another filter, then I'll know where to look. You know, I'll know that, oh yeah, I could go look for this file based on this attribute and see if I have better luck, you know, rather than wading through 80 different results. So that's kind of nice. There are some actions that you can run against these things too. One of them is delete, which I've so far not been brave enough to actually use that. It just makes me nervous. But you can do all kinds of different actions on the results of find, which is kind of nice. I think probably the most common one that you've probably seen online, certainly that's kind of the one that got me interested in executing actions on find results, is the dash exec. So dash exec is execute some command on the result of find. So if I do a find tilde dash iname slacker.txt, actually I'll open that up and do an asterisk slacker asterisk txt space dash exec, and then let's just do, let's say, a base name. To give the argument, you know, obviously if you just say base name and then .txt and then close that statement, which I'll tell you how to do that in a minute, that's not going to work, right? Well, actually, let's do that. So let's do a find tilde dash iname asterisk slacker asterisk text. So we're looking for a file that has slacker in it somewhere and ends in txt. And then we're going to execute a base name, dash exec space base name space dot txt, and then close the command with a forward slash or whatever that is. No, it's a backslash, semicolon, and hit return. And if you've got anything that you're playing along with here, then all you get back are dot txt results. That's all it says, is .txt, .txt, .txt. So there are three slacker .txt files in my home directory, but all I'm seeing in the results is .txt. The reason for that is because I've given a base name argument. I've given nothing but a .txt as the thing to print back from base name. So base name, usually you should have base name, the argument, and then the suffix that you want to chop off. So I'll do an up arrow, and I'll change this dash exec space base name curly bracket space dot txt, and then close the command with a backslash or forward slash, whatever that is, the escape slash semicolon. And then I hit return, and sure enough, I get slackermedia_3ed, slackermedia_corrected, what a horrible name, and newsletter_slackermedia. What is newsletter? I don't know. Point is, there you go. So the two curly brackets, and two empty curly brackets, becomes the find result. Okay? So whatever you want to do with your result of find, you can express that back in your dash exe command as two curly brackets. One thing to note is that it doesn't pipe the dash exec. Your dash exec isn't suddenly, I guess, opening up a subshell. So you couldn't do, for instance, dash exec base name curly bracket space dash dot txt pipe cut and then dash b8 if you just wanted the first eight bytes for some reason. There may be a way to do that in find, for all I know. I don't know it, however, and I haven't looked that hard, but I haven't seen anything that kind of gives you that functionality. Dash exec seems to be kind of a single command, single argument, single command kind of function. But that segues perfectly into the next bash thing that I wanted to talk about, which is xargs. Xargs used to frustrate me to no end, because everyone used to talk about it. Everyone would talk about how powerful it was and how great it is, and everyone would just answer everything with, oh, just send it to xargs, and no one would ever tell you how to use it. Or if they did, it would be a really quick kind of just like this, and they would never explain the theory behind it. So here's the theory behind it as I understand it. Xargs takes the results of one command, which where does that usually go? It goes to standard out, right? Well, xargs turns it on its head and makes that standard out become standard in. Pretty cool, huh? So let's do something without exargs, for instance. So you could say, first make a file. So echo, quote, foo, space bar, space baz, close quote, redirect to foo bar, etc. dot txt. There. So now we've got this file, and it's called foo bar, etc. dot txt. Now, let's say we've got a lot of text files in a directory, and you want to cat the one with the string foo in its name. That's pretty simple, right? You would just say something like cat space $parentheses list, so you're listing all the files, pipe grep dash I insensitive foo close the parentheses. So now we're listing all the files, we're grepping through each list result for the string foo, and whatever we turn up, we want to cat. And so if you do that, wherever you've created that file, you should get foo bar etc. dot txt being catted to your command, to your standard out, as foo bar baz and so on, or whatever you put into your file. So you've just searched the folder for a file with the string foo in the name, and you've catted its content back out into your terminal. Okay, so don't get too excited yet, but we're gonna keep going and see how exargs acts. So here's what we'll do. We'll do an ls and then send that to a pipe, and we'll grep dash I for foo again, and then pipe that over to exargs space cat space dash. Now in this command, we're listing the file, the files in the directory, and then we're grepping each result, we're grepping the list results and filtering everything out except anything with the string foo in the file name. And then we're piping that resulting, that file that remains, the foo bar etc. dot txt, we're piping that to exargs, and we're saying, so now it was our standard out, correct? So now we flipped it on its head, now it's our standard in, so we're sending to exargs as a standard in, and we're saying cat space dash. And the dash, of course, means, and this is from a tip that I got from Ken Fallon seasons and seasons ago, it means the standard input. It doesn't work with every command under the sun, but it works with lots. So exargs space cat space dash. So now you're saying cat whatever the standard input is. And sure enough, if you run that command, you will get into your terminal the same thing that you just got before, where we did cat the subshell results of ls grep dash I foo. So, I mean, in that case, of course, it took more typing to do the same thing with exargs as you could have done previously, but I just wanted you to see how it truly does take the standard output result of something and acts upon it as if though it was standard input. So now taking that even a step further and really using exargs in a way that I guess it makes more sense to use it would be to, for instance, in one command, we could grep. We could grep for the word, windows in dot slash, so in the current directory, asterisk dot html. So any HTML file in this current directory that we're in now, we could grep for the word windows in that file. Now we could do even a dash l, which will give us the results as a, it will give us a single result for each file in list form, but it won't give us the same file back twice if Windows occurs like twice in that file. So, and that's a trick that I learned from Jay Lindsay actually in IRC. So grep windows dot slash asterisk dot html space dash l, and then pipe that into exargs. So now think about what's happening. We're grepping for Windows in any HTML file in the current directory. So we're getting back an argument, or we're getting a result, is the word I'm looking for, into standard out. So now we're piping it to exargs, which flips it on its head and puts that as the input file now, right? So exargs space sed, S-E-D, space dash E to do this experimentally. We don't want to really do this just in case we screw something up. Single quote S underscore Windows underscore Linux underscore G, close single quote. So now, what we've essentially done, believe it or not, is we've written a really cool kind of shell script or a for loop almost, in which we say, grep for anything with the term Windows in it, in this directory, if it's an HTML file, send that as standard input to xargs, and upon that standard input, apply a sed command, which takes the word Windows and switches it with Linux throughout the file, and then then continue on with the next result. The dash L command is important on that grep because it's, or the flag, because, like I say, it gives you only one result per hit, per grep hit, and it also doesn't give you extra information in your results. So, like, if you just run just the grep on those files, you'll get the dot slash, the name of the file, and then colon, what grep found. Whereas if you do the same thing with a dash L, you'll see that you just get the file name back. So that's what's enabling xargs to see things as they really are. But the cool thing, I think, is that it's basically like a for loop without actually having to be a for loop, which, you know, sometimes that's handy. I mean, it's not the most, I guess, groundbreaking thing in the world, but it could be helpful. So that is a really cool trick, xargs. It's something that you can add to your toolkit, to your bag of tricks. That and find, I find both infinitely useful for a lot of different tasks. So play around with both of them. See, you know, what works with them, what doesn't work. I have to admit, it took me a long time to understand exactly what xargs wanted from me. It really took me probably way too long for me to completely get what xargs expected. And what you have to remember is that xargs wants a single file name as an input, more often than not. I mean, it depends on what you're having xargs do. But for the stuff that I use, where I'm like, here, give me some results, and now on that result, do something. If you're returning it a big, non-separated, just kind of a big conglomerous list that it can't delineate in any way, that's not going to work. That will not work. And if it's not progressive, it won't work. If you just keep giving it the same file over and over, it's not going to do anything, or it's not going to do what you want it to do. So kind of understand what xargs wants from you as standard input, and it kind of, it starts to make sense. I promise. And find is just really cool. It's a lot easier than you might expect. One little thing that people sometimes run into after I show them find are they try to find things from the root file system, which sometimes makes a lot of sense, but you have to be root in order to do that, right? You can't find stuff in the root partition if you don't have permission to see it. So keep that in mind. That'll confuse you sometimes. But other than that, those are two basically simple commands that once you get used to them, they can be really, really powerful. So knock yourself out. Things about GNU Linux is the discovery, the exploration, the finding new stuff that you didn't know existed before, and just you fall in love with it. And that's all over the place in Linux because there are so many free software projects out there, and there's such an opportunity to discover them because they're free to try. So you try something that maybe you didn't even expect to be trying. Next thing you know, you've got a great new software that you really, really enjoy and that you can recommend to others. So these are two applications that I really, really have enjoyed lately. And I happened to cross them both completely by accident. One is AcidRip. AcidRip is a, as you might expect from the name, a DVD ripping software. It is really an interesting project because it is really a GUI front end for MPlayer and Mincoder, but it's one of those GUI front ends that is written in Perl, or, you know, I mean, the toolkit that it uses for the GUI is GTK2, but by utilizing the GTK2 Perl module, it actually has, like, this really nice GTK GUI interface, and it's just a front-end for MinCoder, so it's not really doing anything too incredible. I mean, it is, but, it also isn't. I mean, it's just a front-end for MinCoder, which, I mean, so many other applications that rip are, so it's not surprising. But I love this kind of project, because this is exactly what it's all about, right? You got a free software project like Perl, and you have another one like MinPlayer, MinCoder, and you have yet another one like GTK, and someone with the smarts comes along and says, hey, I can use Perl, because I know that language, to interface with MinCoder, because that's not hard, because all you're doing is parsing the output so that you detect all the track names and stuff like that, give me a nice menu. And then they realize, oh, I can even tie into GTK with this GTK Perl module, and suddenly it becomes super user-friendly and GUI and nice. And I shouldn't have actually said that. I shouldn't say user-friendly and GUI, as if though a GUI demands that it's going to be user-friendly, or user-friendly demands a GUI. But you get the point, that you can string these things together and come up with this very accessible, non-threatening software to do something that could be very difficult, like ripping DVDs. So I'm really impressed by this kind of thing, especially when I see essentially a multimedia application written in Perl. That's cool to me, because you don't think of Perl as a multimedia kind of language. You know, that's just not what you think of it as. Right or wrong, it's just not typically, at least, what I associate Perl with. So it's very cool. Although I have to say that one of my favorite multimedia applications, sort of a forensics tool, I call it, is Video Meta, I think. And it's this Perl script that someone wrote. Again, it actually interfaces with MPlayer and MinCoder. And they wrote it for Linux Magazine or something like that. And I've used that on every system that I have for quite a while now, because it's just such a nice little application to give you all the details in a really easy to parse kind of list of, hey, here's the bitrate, here's the length, here's the codec that it uses, all that kind of information. So it's really a cool little Perl script. But anyway, this is cool because it strings together a bunch of applications, or technologies, I should say, to do something like ripping DVDs. The way I found it was that I was going to install Handbrake on Magia Linux, which is the new fork, I guess, of like Mandriva / Mandrake / whatever. And Handbrake didn't exist for Magia. And I tried to grab a Fedora RPM and kind of cram it onto the Magia thing, and it just wouldn't really work. And I was doing this for an article that I was writing, so I probably could have just grabbed the source code for the command line version of Handbrake, and I probably could have just compiled it if I was just doing it for myself. But I wanted the GUI there for screenshots and stuff, and it just wasn't really working in a timely fashion. I could have modified the RPM. You know, there were ways around this, but I felt I'm on the clock here, as it were. You know, I'm trying to write this article in a timely fashion and not spend all week on it. So I think, well, there's a half a dozen other DVD rippers out there. Why don't I just try one of those? And if it seems easy and friendly and stuff, I'll instead of writing about Handbrake for this, you know, this two paragraph segment, I'll write about this other thing. So I just kind of looked through the Magia. I think it was even in the free repository. I don't even think it was in the non-free repository. I could be wrong about that. But I looked in the repository and came across, you know, there's DVD rip, I think, is one of them. And that has always felt a little bit obtuse to me. Like, the workflow is just really, I mean, it's very precise, because you can actually define VOB folders and things like that. So you can really kind of tell it exactly how you want the thing processed. But, I mean, I don't know. Ripping DVDs for me has never been something. I mean, you're ripping something from a compressed format to another compressed format. I don't need control in those cases. Just throw a a lot of bitrate at it and just tell it to do the best it can, because you're really doing something that's just really ugly anyway. So DVD ripping for me, I just think it really ought to be something really easy. I don't think it should be something too complex. So Acid Rip pops up, and I install that, launch it. It's a great application, very easy to use. It gives you a screen. You can title the rip that you're going to make. You can choose which track you want to rip, and then you can override it. You can define the intended file size, or you can flip over to the next tab and define lock in a bitrate, and it will calculate the end file size and kind of give you an approximate idea of how big that will be, and then you can start ripping, or you can add it to a queue and then define other tracks that you want to rip along with it. You can do one pass or two pass ripping. You can do all the basics. You know, you can do all the normal kind of DVD ripping kind of things. One thing that did surprise me a little bit was its lack of choices in what codec you could use to rip to. But again, I'm not really that sold on the idea of having that many options on ripping DVDs. As long as it rips to something that I can play on Linux, I figure I'm going to be happy. I would love to have Theora or actually Xvid as a choice, one of those two, but it's not a deal breaker. And I have a feeling it's either the default install of the Acid Rip that came with Magia, or it's the way that my Magia was set up and it didn't have all the stuff that I would have otherwise wanted on it, like maybe the development libraries for Xvid and or Theora. So not that big of a deal, and it wasn't something that I wanted to look into. But the bottom line is that Acid Rip is a really nice, kind of slender, basic application to do a task that I want to spend less and less time thinking about. It's almost to the point now where I think ripping DVD video ought to just be integrated with the OS. Just grab all the tracks from it, dump it into a folder for me, I'll pick through it and figure out what I want to keep and what I want to toss out, and then I'll shelve the DVD and never use it again. You know, I mean, that's my workflow lately. So Acid Rip is really nice. You should look at it if you have not already. I'm going to try to package it up for Slackware at some point, I think, because I really do like it. I love Handbrake, so don't get me wrong. I mean, Handbrake is really cool, but it does feel like sort of maybe a slightly larger application than what I need. I mean, it has all those presets for devices that I literally or probably am never going to use or need my video to go out to, which is very handy for a huge segment of the population. But for me, I kind of feel sometimes like Handbrake is a very large entity, which is why I usually, like when I'm installing it myself, I often just install the command line version, because I feel that the GUI is overkill sometimes. Again, I love Handbrake. I got nothing against it, so I'm not trying to slander it. I think it's a great project, but I do think that Acid Rip, it felt a lot lighter to me and a lot less complex. So you should try it if it's available for your distribution easily. Give it a quick run through. I think you might like it. The other application that I recently sort of just kind of came across on accident is actually a very famous one that you'll certainly have heard of, and it's called Yast, Y-A-S-T. And of course, this is the main hub, the sort of central nervous system of OpenSUSE, the OpenSUSE distribution, from what I kind of gather, is kind of centers itself around, constructs itself around the idea that Yast exists. This is the big selling point of OpenSUSE in a way. And I've never really given OpenSUSE much time at all. When I looked at it, you know, it's always seemed very polished and everything. I've never had a bad impression of it, other than some of its licensing deals with Microsoft. But in terms of the distribution itself, I knew that it was well respected and that it was a professionally done kind of Linux distribution. So I expected it to be nice, and it is. It seems very nice. I'd never really had a chance to try or to use Yast. I'd never had a reason to use Yast, because the only time I was using OpenSUSE was either as a live environment where all I needed was a terminal on a Linux box, or maybe boot up and start the installer just to write an article on it. Something very simple like that. Never really messing around with it too much. But I recently got asked to write an article about OpenSUSE and their tumbleweed distribution. Their tumbleweed for OpenSUSE is their rolling distro model. So if you switch all your servers over to tumbleweed, I guess it's akin to running Debian with SID or on SID or whatever, Slackware on current, that sort of thing. Running Rawhide, Fedora, whatever. So it's a rolling distribution, and it's considered very unstable. You know, unstable. You know, it has all the packages fresh off of the RPM construction site. I was writing about that, and that a lot of that happens in Yast because you have to deactivate your default repositories, add new ones, you need to run an update, you know, little things like that. And all of that could be done through Yast, which surprised me. I don't know, for whatever reason, I thought, well, break out the terminal and start using Zipper. And you could do it that way as well, but I just kind of stumbled across Yast and everything was right there. And I started looking at Yast, and it turns out everything you'd ever want to do is right there in Yast. And if you've listened to my show for any amount of time, you probably know that I am deep down a fan of that kind of centralized hub of information, whether it's for packages that are available for your distribution, you know, software with pretty icons, or whether it's what hardware your computer actually contains within it, or whether in this case Yast, it does everything. You can do everything through Yast. I was so impressed, and let me explain what I mean by everything. Package management, repository management, running updates for your packages, for your OS. And then there's other stuff like configuring a mail server, configuring your web server, configuring LDAP with Samba, configuring Samba, configuring NFS shares. You name it, you can do it through Yast. I think the significant thing about that model is that you are telling people what they can do. You're not necessarily holding their hand saying, here's how you do it. You're not necessarily saying, here, let me do it for you without your involvement. But you're just giving them a list of all the potential, all the possibilities. And a lot of times that's really, really more important than I think we realize. Because here's the two extremes, right? There's a proprietary OS out there that I used to have to support, well, still support, and they used to have a server distribution, a server edition, and it was horrible. No one, I think, claims otherwise. It's a really horrific entity. And one of the things that they do is they have this little application called Server Control Panel, maybe, I don't know, and you open it up, and there's everything that you can possibly do on a server in an over-GUI-fied kind of control panel, and it offers you no explanation of what any of it means. It's just, it's really badly done, and there's no apparent way to do it any other way. You know, that's your one gateway into this operating system acting like a server, and if they don't have an option for something, then you just don't get to do that thing. That's probably not entirely true. There's probably some stuff that you could do in configuration files, but this proprietary OS, like so many proprietary OSs, they don't really talk too much about configuration files. That's not really something that they do. They try to manage that for you. That was really, really badly done, and it was laughable, and it was horrible, and the server edition of that OS eventually died because it was so bad. Opposite end of the spectrum, there's a very well-respected Linux server distribution called Red Hat. You might have heard of it. And the first time that I booted that one up, I was a little bit overwhelmed at how non-interactive it was, I guess. I mean, it was just like, okay, you've just installed Red Hat. And that's it. I mean, there was no indication of what you could do with it. There was no indication of, like, you know, a little pop-up paperclip that says, hi, it looks like you're trying to set up a server. You know, there's nothing saying or kind of guiding you where to go next. And I can respect that, too. But that is definitely, of those two things, it's totally opposite, right? There's the, here, I will do everything for you, and we'll do it really badly. And then there's the, I'm not going to do anything for you. I thought you knew what you were doing when you installed me. And those are two huge extremes that I wouldn't, if I had to choose, I'd go with Red Hat, because you can always read up on what you need to do and then do it. Whereas on the other one, where they're just doing everything for you and doing it badly, there's really no way around that. And if there is, it's a battle on how to circumvent their pre-built systems, which I'm not interested in doing. But I think there's this really cool middle ground of Yast, where you can install this thing, and suddenly you have a sort of a menu, you know, you have like this thing, and it says, hey, here's everything you could do with this box. You could set up a web server. And maybe you don't know how to do that, and you click on that button, and you see all the different configuration options, and maybe it makes sense, maybe it doesn't yet, but it's something to go on, and I think that's important. I'm not saying every server distribution out there should have that kind of thing, because a lot of us don't need it. I mean, again, I honestly would not use Yast if I was, well, when I'm setting up a server OpenSUSE doesn't come to mind because it doesn't come to mind. But now that I know about YES, I still don't think I would choose it for myself because I don't need it. I guess I don't need it. I could probably use it. Heck, I mean, like I say, just having that kind of configuration stuff right there in a mostly digestible form seems really powerful to me. I would rather just read up on the subject and learn it and kind of hammer it out from configuration files and just kind of figure it out myself. But that's who I am. There's a crowd out there, and I know some of them, who would love to set up a home server, maybe. And setting up, like, you know, Fedora or Debian or Slackware, and just after the install, it's all over. You're just like, okay, now go ahead, set it up. And there's no indication of what that means. I mean, for the longest time, for me, setting up a server, what did that mean? You know, I mean, like, what's the first step? What questions do you even ask? There's just no entry point, it seems. You just are supposed to know. So I think having YAST hinting to people what they should look into, what they need to figure out in order to make this happen, is a very, very helpful thing. I was impressed with YAST. I really was. I was pleasantly surprised by it. I didn't expect it to be bad, but it was one of those applications that I've heard that some people love, and then other people seem to mention it sort of and groan. You know, it's like, oh, yes, yeah, yeah. Seeing it for myself and seeing, I mean, it's an attractive little control panel, very manageable. It's got icons that you can click, and there's information in it, and it just seemed really, really nice. And I even like that they have hardware profiles in there. I mean, I'm telling you, they have everything you would want to know about your computer or what you could do with it is there in YAST, and that's very powerful, I think. And I think that there's a market for that, and I don't think we should just write that sort of thing off because we're all Linux pros and we don't need GUI control panels, and that all GUI control panels are bad. I mean, they can get annoying. GUI control panels can get very annoying very quickly. I mean, after you've done the same process twice, you're ready to get away from the GUI. Believe me, I'm all for that. But for people who maybe want that GUI or aren't used to the server thing at all anyway and could use some kind of indication of where to go next, I think YAST is a powerful tool. So keep it in mind. Keep in mind that YAST exists. And if anyone in your life is asking, hey, how do I set up a home server or whatever, and they're gravitating towards some proprietary solution because it's just so easy, keep in mind OpenSUSE. It's got a lot going for it. Okay, I think it's time for a second coffee break. I know you're thinking, two coffee breaks in one episode? This is unheard of. Hey, I told you, season finale. It gets crazy. But besides, can you really have too many? So sit back, relax, enjoy that other cup of coffee, and we'll continue in a moment. That second coffee break was a little bit misleading because I actually only have about two topics left to cover. But hey, I really wanted a second cup of coffee, and I kind of assumed that you did too, so we did it. Next thing that I want to talk about is a little bit about KDE, specifically about the right-click menus in KDE. So if you're a KDE user, and you should be, or you could be anyway, if you're a KDE user, you know that there are a lot of right-click menus. I call them contextual menus. So if you have a file and you right-click, it will give you a certain number of options that you could potentially do to that file. Cut, copy, rename, move to trash, open with, look at properties, compress, and a couple of other things. Cool thing about KDE being so configurable is that you can actually add your own options into that menu really, really easily and on a per user basis. Now, you can do it system-wide as well. I'm going to attack it as a per-user type of task because I think in the long run, very frequently, that's the way you really want to do stuff. It makes things a lot more portable if you do that. You know, I mean, like, if I used to do a lot of things on the system-wide basis, and then I realized that, well, I'm kind of fooling myself because I'm the only user of this computer anyway, and if I do it on a system-wide basis, then I have to either remember, which I'll never do, to copy all that system stuff over to my backups or to my new computer that I'm starting to use or whatever. Whereas if it's all in my home directory, then it all gets transferred anyway, whenever I either back up my home folder or take it to my new computer. It's just all there. So I've been installing like fonts and little scripts and stuff like that on a per user basis, just because it really is more, it's more logical for the way that I'm, for my computer use. So I'll be doing it on a per user basis, but it can be adapted if you're actually maintaining a computer that lots of people use under different logins. You can do all of this on a system-wide basis as well. So the way to do this is very interesting. It's with sort of a .desktop file, which you might know, and I've actually talked about the .desktop files before, but you might know it from, say, your application menu, whatever you're using, whether it's GNOME or KDE. It's a free desktop .org spec, so it's something that exists as a part of a generic kind of movement toward, hey, we're going to be doing the Linux desktop in this way. And it's I really am really fond of the .desktop files. I think they're brilliant ideas. They're easy to understand. They're easy to copy and kind of leech off of. And they make things really, really cross-platform, or not cross-platform. Well, they do, I guess, but they ensure that if you do something for a GNOME desktop, then it'll be easy to port over to KDE as well, because it's part of the free desktop spec. So that's cool. And this is done with .desktop files. So there's a location in your home directory, if you're using KDE, /.kde/share/kde4/services, and then there may or may not be a folder already existing within that location called service menus. So once again, that's /.kde, so that's the hidden directory with all your KDE configuration files. On some distributions, they may still be using, they might still be calling that .kde4. So you may have to adapt that a little bit. On Slackware, it's .kde. So /.kde, and then within that folder, there's a bunch of little folders like an auto start and a data and environment and share. That's the one you want. Share, and then within share, there's a KDE4 directory, and within KDE4 there's a services directory, and that's kind of where you need to be, .kde/share/kde4/services. There may or may not already exist a service menus directory. That's a capital S and a capital M, service menus. If it doesn't exist yet, you can create it. Just make dir service menus return, and that creates the directory for you. Anything that appears in this service menus directory will be something that you can use in that right-click menu. The syntax of this file is very, well, you need to create a file in it. So let's just make a file, I don't know, I'm just going to call it foo.desktop, because I haven't really decided what I want to do with this yet. So we'll just call it foo.desktop. And touch that file, or just open it up with Emacs. The first entry is the standard entry for a desktop, a .desktop file, which is square bracket desktop space entry close square bracket. You can see this kind of thing all over the place. If you look in /user/share/applications, look at any of the desktop files in there, you kind of get the feel for the desktop spec. You can also look this up on freedesktop.org. The .desktop file spec is available pretty easy to find online. So the type of the type argument here is service. So that's just type equals service. The action can be anything you want. In this case, we'll just stick with foo. So we'll say actions equals foo. The action is going to be something that we define later. So we're almost creating a function here. So it can be literally anything you want. Actions equals foo will work for us. Icon equals some icon that you would probably find in /usr/share/pixmaps. So you can either add an icon to that directory, or you can use something that already exists. That's just the standard system location for all your icons. That's not really all that unusual. Encoding equals UTF-8. You're probably using UTF-8. You can do a try exec or not. I usually don't bother. The version, you can specify a version, doesn't really matter. Service types equals, and this is kind of important, it's a conk pop-up menu / plugin. So that is KONQ pop-up menu / plugin. And I'll tell you where to find one of these sample files in a moment. The MIME type will equal something, and this will be dependent upon what kind of file you actually want to manipulate. So if you're doing something like you only want this service to pop up in the event that it's an image file, like an image / PNG, then you would define here what MIME type this entry should be available for. This is important because obviously if you're writing some kind of plugin or service menu selection for that would only apply to a JPEG image or a PNG image, then you wouldn't want this option to be available if someone was right-clicking on a .txt file. Makes sense, right? So you want to kind of define what MIME type this makes sense to give the user the option to do this on. And that can be anything. Just look up all the MIME types online. They're pretty easily available. They're used on the internet in the htaccess files. They're used on your system to recognize what kind of file should be opened in what kind of in which application and so on. So define what kind of file you want this to act upon. If you don't define anything here, I imagine it would work on anything. I've not tried that yet, but it's gives you the opportunity to give a proper context to what you're writing. So all of that's just the standard desktop entry kind of stuff. It's kind of saying, here's my entry into a menu. The type in this case is a service. It's not, for instance, an application or anything. It's a service. The action that we're going to refer to is some random string that you invent. And here's the icon and the encoding. The service type is conk pop-up menu / plugin. That's just for this right-click menu. And then the MIME type that we want it to apply to. Pretty basic conceptually. You see it done once and you can kind of reverse engineer it for yourself. So desktop action is the next entry, and that's something new. I'd never done this before. So instead of saying desktop entry in square brackets, you're now saying square bracket desktop action or desktop space action space. And remember, we called our action, in this case, foo. We said actions equals foo. So we call our action here foo. See, so we've kind of, we declared what we were going to call it, and now we're calling it that thing, so the entry knows where to refer. So desktop action space foo, close square bracket. So now we're in the actual action division of our service pop-up menu. And we can do things like, well, the name. So that'll be the name of the menu, like the menu item. When we right-click, what we'll see is whatever we put here. So you can put, for instance, convert foo to bar, or whatever your little process is going to be. That's what'll show up when you right-click. You can give it an icon. Icon equals, whatever, /usr/share/pixmaps/ tux.png or something like that, or I guess tux.x, I think it's xpm is the bitmap format that these seem to really like, and you can always create xpms out of like pngs or whatever with image magic. So dump an xpm file in /usr/share/pixmaps and then refer to that icon here, and that will become the little icon in your right-click menu if you've got icons turned on. Or not. You can not use an icon and there will not be an icon there, and that's fine too. The the action, the actual thing that's going to happen occurs in the exec line. So exec, you're familiar with that from your .xinitrc file, or from maybe you've run it in bash if you want to execute a certain script or something like that, then that's kind of familiar. So exec equals something, and that you can refer, you can give a line command here. You could say exec equals, I don't know, convert foo dash scale 50% bar. You know, that's just kind of an imaginary kind of image magic command. Maybe that would be like if you're creating thumbnails, then you could be doing a convert foo.png dash scale 50% bar dash thumbnail.png. Something like that. Now, if you wanted to get more complex, then you could actually just refer to a script, a shell script. And in that case, you could put like convert foo.sh and then make sure that convert foo.sh is in your path somewhere. So it could either be in /usr/local/bin, or you could put it in your home directory in /bin, as long as that's in your path. And then it would know to execute convert foo.sh wherever it lies in your path on the app, on the file that you've defined. And that's really kind of it. So now let's go through one that actually does something. Although I should mention first that you can actually download pre-built services for a lot of common things. You know, I mean, when I was looking into this, the first thought I had was to do something that ended up being so common that of course there were like half a dozen service menu entries already made by someone else available for free download via kdeapps.org or kde-look.org, whatever it's called. But the even easier way to get it, more direct way, is to go into Dolphin, go to the settings menu, go to configure Dolphin, and in the services tab on the left, you see all the services that are activated in contextual menus. And just under that, there's a download new services button. And that actually looks at kdelook.org, and you can find lots and lots of services right there that you can just download and install literally with one click. And like I say, a lot of the very, very common sort of normal things that you'd want to do, they're already there. You know, image to PDF, post an image to Tumblr. Not that I've ever done that, but one might. YouTube stuff that you can download videos from YouTube and convert them. Make desktop shortcuts, PDF tools, video conversion, image conversion, all kinds of things that you've, you know, if you're thinking, gee, I should write myself a desktop file to do that, it might already exist, so it wouldn't hurt to check it out. The other advantage to doing it that way, if you do intend to do your own, is you get to see how it's done, confirm that it works, and you get the benefit of learning from someone else who has already done it. So if you do download and install one of those things, just go on over to your .kde/share/kde4/services/service menus, and sure enough, the desktop files, the .desktop files that you just downloaded and installed will probably be right there. So that's a good way to cheat. But for now, let's cheat by actually doing it ourselves. So create a new entry, a new desktop file, .desktop file, in .kde/share/kde4/services/service menus, capital S and a capital M for that last one. And we'll call it a desktop entry, and the actions we'll give it, we'll call convert image. And the encoding is UTF-8. And the service types, we'll give it conk popup menu /plugin, comma /all/all files. That's probably not really true, but let's do it anyway. And we'll exclude a certain service type. So we'll exclude service types, and that's camel cased, exclude service types equals KDE device /*. So any KDE device we won't provide this option for. comma, inode slash directory. So for directories, we will not include this option in our contextual menu. And then the type equals service. Okay. So that's just that's kind of us defining variables. And then we will do a square bracket desktop space action space convert image, because that's the action we said we were creating, close square bracket. So the name of this will be, let's just call it convert space image. And again, this is just the human readable thing that will actually appear in the pop-up menu. And for good measure, I'm going to go ahead and give it a name, square bracket, en, close square bracket, equals convert image. And that way we're explicitly saying for the English, if our locale is en, then we'll give it that name. And if you know any other language, you could put that in there as well. So I might put in name, square bracket, eo, equals convert to Bildo, and that would be the Esperanto for convert image. And I don't really know any other language well enough off the top of my head to do that. So that gives us some human readable stuff for the contextual pop-up menu. And now we'll give it an icon. So icon equals slash USR slash share slash pixmaps slash tux.xpm. And again, you can generate your own .xpms really easily with convert from ImageMagick. And now I'm going to do this. I'm going to do an exec equals convertImage.sh percent lowercase f. That is f as in file. Now all that does, again, is call a script called convertimage.sh upon the file that I have right-clicked on, right? So there are ways to do this such that it can that variable, the percent thing, can receive multiple arguments, and that would be a percent capital F. So if you want to enable your script to act upon a selection of things, of files, rather than just one file at a time, you could use percent capital F, but then the script that you ultimately run will have to deal with the fact that percent F is going to give them multiple items. I haven't played around with that much yet, so I'm not going to bother trying to integrate that into this example. But it is something that you can do. And like I say, the possible variables, the percent lowercase f, the percent capital F, whatever you want to put in there, are all available in the .desktop file spec. They're listed, and there's a little bit of flexibility added, you know, if you know those variables. So now you need to, so we'll save that. So now that exists. So technically speaking, if you restart Dolphin, so if there's an open Dolphin window, just close it and get a new window open. And now if you go and find, well, really anything, because we said it should appear on any kind of file, which again is not really correct. We wouldn't actually want a convert image thing to appear for a .txt or a .tgz or a .torrent or a .ppd. You know, you wouldn't really want that, but we're just doing it just so we see it. But if you right-click on something, you should see that item possibly in the actions directory. So if you have a pop-up menu with actions, look in there. That might be where it gets dumped. It kind of depends on how you have KDE set up and how many other actions you have installed. But that's, so far, usually, that's where it's appeared for me. So it's there, but there's, of course, no convertimage.sh. So, I mean, this isn't really a shell script tutorial, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on that. But what I would do is I would go to my /bin folder, which you may or may not have, but if you do, I mean, I have it, and that's where I keep all my little custom scripts that, again, it's nicely portable, because then you take it over to your other computer, and as long as you're bringing over your home directory, then you've got everything in your in your tilde/bin. So I would go there and create a new file called convertimage.sh and open that up in Emacs or whatever. And the opening line for this, I do it with the shebang, you know, that's the hash exclamation mark slash /usr/bin/env/bash. I forget where I learned that trick, but apparently using env as the thing that you're calling in your shell script and then saying space bash, you're actually probing the env variable and asking, okay, where's bash, rather than trying to hard code where bash is. And that makes it such that if bash is not installed in the, you know, where you would expect it to be, you still get bash. So obviously on Linux, it's very frequently in /bin/bash. But what if you're running this script on BSD, where bash is quite frequently /usr/local/bin/bash, then you inherit that just with that one line, which is kind of nice. So we'll say that this is a bash script, and then we will do our little conversion script, which would simply be, in this case, I mean, we're just converting. We didn't even say what we're converting to. So it would just be convert space. Now, you don't inherit the %f in this script, right? You can't say convert %f to, you know, dash scale 50%, whatever else you want to do with it, and then %f.thumb.png or whatever you would then call it. So what you need to do is you need to get the name of the file that you're running this script on. The way that I've always done that is I simply say something like, arg equals $1. $1, of course, becomes whatever file the script is called to act upon. So if you look back at your .desktop file, we have in the exec line, we have entered convertimage.sh %f, meaning we've essentially passed to the computer, we're running this shell script on this file, and we substitute %f, we substitute that with the name of the file that we've right-clicked on. So if it's foo.png, we're essentially saying convertimage.sh foo.png. Therefore, when we get to our shell script, we know that the $1, the first argument being passed to this script, is foo.png. So I'm just saying arg equals $1. I don't really need to do it that way. I could just keep using $1, but for whatever reason, I got into the habit of swapping it out with a real, like a recognizable variable for myself, and so I've done that forever. So that's how I do it. So then, now that we have our image in arg, we'll say convert space $arg dash scale 50%, or insert your cool image magic tricks here. And then the output, let's just call it thumb_arg.png. And there's obviously fancier ways of doing that. What we might really want to do is say thumb_parentheses base name of arg, and then figure out what the suffix is and give it a new format. So maybe it would be .jpg or something. And even in that case, you might want to actually find out what the base name, what if it's a .jpeg or what if it's a .png, so you could do cool tricks like, okay, give me the full path with a read link -f$arg, reverse it, cut the last field off, and give me the last three, or maybe give me the last field before the for the first period, and that could be your, and reverse that, and that would be your suffix. So you can do all kinds of cool parsing of text in the shell script to figure out what exactly you're actually acting upon, and then you can run convert against that, chopping off that suffix and adding a new suffix onto it. All kinds of neat tricks that you can do. And like I say, I would go into that, but I feel like that's getting into bash scripting rather than just adding a service menu to KDE. Okay, so once you save that, you would chmod it. Chmod plus x on /bin/convertimage.sh. That gives it executable permissions. And now if we restart Dolphin, so close the current Dolphin window if it's open, we don't really have to probably, but let's do it anyway. Click on something that actually would make sense for this to occur to. For instance, here's a PDF, mumblehowto.pdf, right click, actions, convert image. And then you would convert that image. And that will convert my .pdf to a scaled down version of itself. I don't know how that'll work. And save it back out. And it's done as a thumbnail. Or a smaller size, I should say. Web version, I guess. I don't know why I did it on a PDF. I should really do it on a PNG. Let's do a PNG instead. Actions, convert image, PNG. And there you go. Now, like I say, a lot of this stuff is already done. So the convert image trick really is quite useless because built into KDE, at least this version that I have, I've already got convert to JPEG, PNG, GIF, or TIFF. So really doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to go rewrite that. And probably any kind of media conversion you'd want to do, that's probably already done as well. But it's a great trick to know about because there are a couple of things that you might want to do that aren't built in and that no one else has thought to do. Like running it through FOP, for instance, or running something through some kind of sed script that you're using frequently. The sky is the limit. And in fact, I wrote one for a friend. Well, actually, I wrote two. One for work, because I did need a very specific movie conversion to occur. And it was just that easy to make it into a right-click convert to HD video. And it would take this raw video dump that we were getting from a telecine machine and convert it to XVID, I think. XVID HD. So that was really handy. And then I wrote one for a friend because, as many of my friends are, they're used to a very specific operating system, and they are used to, in this operating system, being able to color code files randomly. It's kind of a metadata thing. You can just right-click on it and label it a certain color, like red or blue, and it kind of gives this blue stripe to your file name. And they like that. So I wrote one that would take a file and give it a specific icon. I couldn't figure out how to make Dolphin, I couldn't invent a new thing for Dolphin to suddenly give color codes to files. There's a bug, there's an open feature request for that on KDE, but no one seems to be jumping on it. But I got it to at least give a new icon to the file. It's not perfect because it actually ruins the MIME type and it doesn't open up by default in the right application anymore, but this was for a very specific task, and so I was able to get around that by just defining that MIME type as something that would also open in the same application. So it's not at all universal. It wouldn't work as expected on any kind of file, but it was for a very specific task. So it kind of worked out. But the point is that it's really easy to add. You can make things that work specifically for you and how you use KDE, or even a specific task. And I've done that before where under normal circumstances, I would never do this. Like, for instance, running something through FOP. That's just not something that I do every day. But when I'm down to the wire during, you know, if I'm finishing up a version of Slacker Media or some kind of book that I'm doing, then I'm converting to FOP a lot. That's something that I'm frequently doing because I need to run it through, see what errors I get, and then inevitably go back and fix a bunch of stuff. And sometimes I'm just doing that, like, you know, five times an hour or five times every half hour. At that point, adding a quick service menu and just having something that I can quickly do if I need it just makes things easy for that moment, for that hour or two that I need it. And that kind of flexibility just continually blows me away. That's not something that you can do on other platforms. Really, it's not. You can come up with workarounds, you can come up with things that are similar, but more often than not, I have found, back on my old proprietary OS days, there would be times like this all the time where I would just be like, I just want this one little extra function. It would just make my life easier right now, maybe just for today, but it would be profound if I could have it just for today. And there's just no way. And there were times where I would spend literally a day looking for someone else's free where version of this thing that I needed to do. And a lot of times I wouldn't be able to find it. And I would keep looking, and I'd keep looking. Or I would find it, but it would be this completely other application that you know, it ends up slowing you down further because there's just no way to integrate that into the way that you're doing what you're doing. The ability to do that on GNU Linux is amazing. I mean, the fact that we can do that, normal people, not programmers, I'm not a programmer, I can still completely customize my environment in very significant ways. I mean, yeah, I can't write a completely new video editor or you know, whatever, but I mean, I can make huge changes to the way that I work, to the speed with which I get stuff done, the efficiency. That's a huge deal to me. That's honestly one of the biggest selling points of GNU Linux. And of course, that's bound very, very closely to the freedom aspect of GNU Linux, right? I mean, a lot of people still don't quite get the significance of the free part of free software. See, I'm bringing it back around to the beginning of the episode. But the fact that we can go in and make these kinds of changes I want to say OS level, although technically speaking, I guess it's not the OS level. It's like the desktop environment level. But to normal people, that is the OS. So at that level, you can make all these cool changes to literally revolutionize. Yes, I used that buzzword. Revolutionize the way that you work. I mean, that's a big deal. And other operating systems don't give you that. And they don't give it to you because they don't need to. They don't give it to you because they don't want to. They don't want you messing around with the code. They don't give it to you because they don't want to have to support it either. You know, imagine people calling the theoretical, hypothetical, proprietary OS support line as if though they have support lines and saying, hey, I've added this script, I've got this custom script referencing this file, and it comes up in my contextual menu under certain circumstances, and for some reason it's crashing my system. I mean, what are they going to say? You know, you can't support that. So, I mean, the very model of proprietary OS just doesn't let them give you that freedom, whereas GNU Linux, it insists that they give you that freedom. It just gives you that freedom, and that's a really cool thing. And it's an important thing, I think. The Unix philosophy, this is all kind of related in a way, that it's kind of the anarchization. I think typically we say democratization, but I don't know that I agree with that term, so I'm going to say anarchicization of the ability to program and to alter your environment. Shell scripting was one of the, I guess, sort of the, again, revolutionary things about Unix. I'm not positive about that, but I kind of, at least it's very, very promoted within Unix, because of course they're very portable, right? Now, they're not necessarily the fastest thing in the world, but they're really, really efficient. They work, and they're accessible. You don't have to be a programmer to do bash scripting. I myself am testament to that. So the fact that they encourage people, hey, look, just write your own programs. Make this work the way that you want it to work. Put it in your /bin. Port it to other systems. Bring it around with you. It'll work. That's great. That's cool. And I think Python and probably Ruby are kind of the same way, right? They're very, very accessible. They're very, very cross-platform. And all of them aren't the fastest thing in the world because they're all interpreted and stuff like that. But hey, they're very easy for normal people to learn. Bash, probably even more so, at least in my humble opinion, or for me, like from the way my brain works, that's been the thing that's been really, really accessible. The fact that that's happening within the GNU system, you know, this is something that GNU desktops are really, really latching onto. I mean, think of all the Python-based desktop utilities that you find on a typical GNU Linux desktop these days. They're all over the place. I mean, half of Fedora and Red Hat seem to be Python PyGTK applications. It's all over the place, and it's really, really cool, and it's exciting. Maybe it's not the fastest and most efficient program ever. I don't know. I can't tell. But it works, and normal people are making these things, and they're working great. They're doing exactly what we want them to do. They're making things easy and user friendly. They're making things pretty, and anyone can do them. That's exciting stuff, and that's not happening in the proprietary OS. That's not where it's all happening. It's happening here on GNU Linux, and it should not be understated, and it shouldn't be taken for granted. And that stuff is, that's GPL working. I mean, it's not directly the GPL, right? I mean, they could all be BSD licensed, and probably some of them are. But a lot of them are GPL'd, because that's the license that's giving everyone the ability and the right and the obligation to take code and to share it and to modify it and then share it back and just kind of keep that life cycle going. That's important. I don't care what people say about how BSD is more free and the MIT license is more free and all this other nonsense. It doesn't matter if it's more free. It doesn't sustain anything. Whereas the GPL, it sustains the code. It sustains the life of that code. And it encourages people to continue, you know? It brings you in. It says, yes, here's the code. Change it. Share it. Make it even better. And it's collaborative. And that's great. So, somehow, I started out with KDE right-click menus, ended up with complete free software propaganda. Okay, I actually did have one more topic to cover, but I think that that's actually probably a pretty good ending. I don't want to dilute the power of my impassioned speech about free software. So let's just end the episode here. Let's end, in fact, the entire season here. Yes, you knew it was coming, but now it's happened. The season is over, so join me next time for season 8. Until then, of course, I'm Klaatu, and you can find me online at GNUWorldOrder.info. You can find me on IRC as not Klaatu on irc.freenode.net. And I'm usually in Ogcast Planet, or Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of those kinds of channels. You can find me on Jabber as not Klaatu, or you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. Thank you very much for listening. I will talk to you next season.
Have a nice day.